You are listening to South by Southwest Sessions.
Hello, I'm Rashad Robinson, president of Color of Change, a racial justice organization driven by over 7 million members, Black folks and allies of every single race. And I am so excited for this conversation. I want to first and foremost thank South by Southwest for bringing us together. Color of Change and the Recording Academy recently made a commitment to bring racial justice and equity to the music industry. And together we release Change Music, a roadmap which offers industry leaders tangible ways to address inequities within their organization. This is just the first step on the road to actually bringing more equity for Black creators and to the industry. The undeniable influence of music on our country is so clear. And so we're gonna get to work on a conversation, and we have four incredible leaders within the industry and within the industry of diversity that are gonna sort of take us through this. I'm gonna just go through and do some brief introductions, and then we're gonna get to work. Felicia Butterfield Jones has spent over 20 years driving change at the intersections of entertainment, politics, and tech. She is currently Chief of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at the Recording Academy. Felicia formerly served as the Global Head of Inclusion for Google, Deputy Director of Public Affairs for the International Trade in the Obama Administration, and the National Youth Vote Director for Obama for America, helping to deliver one of the highest youth voter turnouts in American history. Felicia is also a mom, wife, an author, and a podcaster as well. Tiffany R. Warren, a heart director and passionate hope dealer. Tiffany R. Warren is the EVP, Chief Diversity and Inclusion Officer at Sony Music Group and founder of Ad Color. Recognized as a leader in the field of diversity, Tiffany is a talented strategist with over 22 years of championing diverse professionals in the creative industry. You must have started when you were 5, Tiffany. Dr. Maurice Stinnett is an experienced leader and expert in the areas of diversity, inclusion, and equity across corporate, nonprofit, and education sectors. He serves as Global Head of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at Warner Music Group. There, he spearheads the equity initiatives and implements tailored strategies and programs designed to cultivate a diverse and inclusive company culture. And Lillian Majeed dedicates herself to promote innovative and diverse programs throughout her SVP, Chief Diversity, Inclusion, and Belonging role at Universal Music Group. She is a proud Howard, Walt Disney World, Four Seasons Hotel, an MBA alum, and committed to ensuring her team members, artists, songwriters, fans, and community partners feel safe, seen, heard, accepted, and respected. Welcome, panelists, to the conversation, and thank you so much for joining. So,
thank you.
I want to start off with the easy question, because we're going to get into some harder questions. And I think that it's always good as we sort of talk about these issues that are complicated, these issues that really stem from systemic challenges in our country, systemic inequality, systemic racism, the ways in which industries animate those things. I actually want to start not with the pain, but with the joy, because music also brings so much joy. And at Color of Change, we talk about Black joy a lot. We center Black joy in so much of our organizing. And Black joy is not the absence of pain, but the presence of aspiration, not just what we are fighting against, but what we are fighting for. And I'd love it if each of you could, just as an icebreaker, so that maybe you could bring a little bit of your personality and some of your love and joy into the room, share an album or a song or a musical moment that sort of represents joy for you. We'll start with Felicia, and then we'll sort of go in the order of the introductions.
Well, first, Rashad, I just want to thank you for moderating this very important discussion with my colleagues here today, who I have so much love and respect for. I'm so excited about the work that we've already done together and that we hope to do And I love, Rashad, that you're starting off with joy during such a difficult time in our country. You know, many of us have been working from home or suffering through a pandemic now for nearly a year and just all the things. And so what brings me joy is the reminder that joy is resistance. Right. And I think so often we carry the burden and the tax of the very heavy that work that we do around racial justice and diversity, equity, and inclusion in our industry, but also in the world. But, you know, music has been the soundtrack of my life. And I think it really has been the soundtrack for me of the pandemic, you know, seeing so many people suffer, so many people struggle, and even, you know, the loss of life over the last year. Music has definitely been the thing that keeps me going. So every Friday night, me and our children just have a bit of a karaoke kind of freestyle moment. And it's so corny and cheesy. You know, we're offbeat. We listen to whatever, you know, makes us feel good on those nights. And I'll definitely say Friday nights with our family with music has been like balm during such a difficult time.
Tiffany?
It's interesting that you asked that question, and thank you for bringing joy into the room first and foremost for this conversation. Actually, the score is celebrating 25 years. I just posted about, you know, that catalytic album. I was in college when it came and it dropped, and I had never heard anything like it. And particularly, you know, two of my very best friends in life are Haitian. And so what that album did for the Haitian community, let alone this college student who sometimes didn't have a vocabulary to go with swag. You know, sometimes you get that swag from listening to music. And to this day, Ready or Not is the anthem that I play when I walk on stage at the Ad Color Awards. So I love Ready or Not, Killing Me Soft. Anything from that album has had a tremendous impact on my life. So yeah, that would be the album that brings me joy.
Rashad, I think I'm next up on the order of operation. Yeah. And thank you so much for having this conversation with us. First and foremost, what brings me joy? My joy is rooted in my faith. And I unapologetically say that. My joy is rooted in the fact that it is not conditional and based upon circumstances. It's anchored in something greater than whatever I'm going through. And so with that being said, the songs that have been on repeat, Travis Green, an artist, and he has two songs out, Intentional and Made a Way. And those two songs have been the soundtrack that, again, my faith that everything that's happening, it's intentional and it's all working for my good and made a way that whatever I'm confronting and whatever's going on, I will get through this. So that's what brings me joy. And then last but not least, hanging out with these wonderful sisters on here, Rashad, I get a chance to meet with them once a month and that brings me joy. So that's what my joy is really making.
Oh my gosh, Maurice, how do I follow that? Oh, so beautiful. You bring us joy as well, Dr. Mo. And this conversation, we're just a few minutes in and I'm already feeling so joyful hearing all of you kind of share your stories. And I echo so much of what all of you said is that joy, and it's hard for me to not shimmy a little bit when I say that word because it plays such a powerful role in our ability to thrive and stay kind of mentally tough, regardless of what's swirling around us. And I think fortunately, I'm genetically wired towards joy. And I even named my daughter, her name is Farah, which means joy in Arabic. And there's so many songs that bring me joy, particularly anything Stevie Wonder and India Arie. So like I dance like no one is watching every time someone puts on As by Stevie. And I start my day with India's A Beautiful Day. And I meditate. I did that just before this conversation to I Am Light. So looking forward to more joy in this conversation. Thank you all for having us.
That was so great. I appreciate that. And you know what was really great about that is all of the sort of talent and creatives that got uplifted in those examples. I want to actually pick up there. You know, each of you are in your first year in these roles. And so an opportunity to like really talk about the future and the path forward. And so I really do want to focus on this unique space of music and racial justice. A lot of times when people categorize music, they will pigeonhole Black artists' contributions into Black music. And when in reality, American music is Black music. At Color of Change, we talk a lot about not mistaking presence for power. You know, when we mistake presence for power, we can sometimes think we've done something that we haven't done. It's not that presence is a bad thing. It's that presence alone doesn't actually change the rules. We can think that because America loves and celebrates sometimes our artists, our creatives, our talent, that they love us, right? And America can love, celebrate, and monetize Black culture and not like and sometimes hate Black people at the same time. And so what does it mean for each of you? And we're going to go the opposite way that we just went. So get ready, Lillian. What does it mean to be inside an industry that has built its foundation from Black genius, Black creativity, Black brilliance, but is sometimes and oftentimes not only stifled Black careers, but stalled them, sometimes stolen from them, and prevented Black innovation? How do you talk? How do you think about moving forward? Lillian, sorry for the mispronunciation.
It's all right, no problem. And you can call me Lil too.
Lil, okay.
Okay. Everything that you just described, I think, really talks about the obligation and speaks to the obligation that we have in these roles that we are. And the monthly conversations that we all have, it is very clear that none of us have taken on these roles to be just pretty window dressing, to just check the box and allow our institutions to say, yep, we have diversity, inclusion, and belonging groups, so we're good. Like, we are here to really drive, pun intended, since we're having this conversation, to drive change. And a lot of what you spoke to really speaks to the fact that, like, music has always been this tool for Black liberation. And our artists and our songwriters and our producers, they wield so much power and influence. And so it is obligating, like, it is our obligation to make sure that we are using that power to really drive change. And so some of the things that I'm really focused on, absolutely internally, and looking at how we can be a force for change, for us to see many, many, many more than there currently are Black and brown heads of labels. But I also believe we have this amazing responsibility to the world, to serve as a bridge to creating a more just society where social and economic outcomes are not influenced by circumstances into which people are born or raised, where race and gender and class and sexual orientation and any other points of difference are no longer obstacles to success. So those are a lot of the conversations that I know that we are all leading about the responsibility that we have to make sure that there are many more Black executives like us at the label, but that we're also using our power and our influence to change to change the world, not just today, but many, many, many hundreds of years into the future.
And I think you said in the opposite direction. So Rashad, that was actually fantastic. Lillian, let me add to that. I think I want to first start off by saying, you ask about this particular industry in the music industry. Rashad, I first would like to say that it's no different than working in any industry in America. I don't know of any industry in America that hasn't done what we've said, those things, and hasn't been built on, again, exploitation of Black genius, Black talent, loving Black folks, and not really honoring the Black body. So I feel a sacred responsibility as Black people. We've always known, again, about Black genius, Black creativity, Black brilliance, but we've known about that exploitation and appropriation and mistreatment. So as far as my role is now, I feel like I carry the responsibility to shine a light on both those realities, right? But also to dream and to reimagine and to disrupt. So I guess what I'm saying in gist is that I need to make sure that I am damn sure that I'm occupying space for these folks in these spaces that we have not historically been allowed to occupy, and that I act fearlessly to disrupt in the industry, to disrupt again and to dislocate and to bring agitation to for all those brilliant Black folks now and that are to come. So I think that's my responsibility.
Thank you, Dr. Mo and Lil. You know, I came from an industry which unfortunately contributed to a lot of stereotypes that fed the way that America sees people of color. And I had to sort of grapple with that as one of the first chief diversity officers within advertising. And I'm acutely aware of how long it takes to break systems that people are very used to benefiting from. And so one of the key things for me is that it's really important now that particularly allies stop playing, you know, being tourists. So just watching what's going on, but not participating, not activating, not being part of the change. And I see part of my job as collaborating and supporting their journey so that we can make better decisions on behalf of artists now and artists that we don't even know. I take this work very, very seriously. And I think that, you know, one of the things that happens, particularly with CDOs and in this position is a lot of it is misunderstood, but all of the individuals on this call are sitting at the head table of their organizations. They're understanding the business impact of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And more importantly, they're getting daily reads on what the business is doing, because you cannot operate in a space of being a chief diversity officer and not know how, where the business is going. You know, particularly with the launch of the National Museum of African American Music that I think many of my partners on the phone are involved, on the panel are involved in, there is a way forward to teach the history that was not taught in school about the contributions of Black artists to country music, to American music in general. So, you know, sometimes there's a thought process of our responsibility rests firmly in HR, when our responsibility rests in every business unit, talent acquisitions, you know, HR definitely is prominent in what people see first and foremost, but there's learning and development. There's other key areas of the business that we all have our hands in. And collectively, if we do make a change in those various business units, we can uplift the whole company, and let alone not just the company, but the industry and then our artists. So, you know, I'm super humbled by the responses from Lil and Dr. Mo, and of course, Felicia, in the sense that we all feel a heavy responsibility that we're in the middle of making history, and that our appointments are historic, no pressure. But, you know, being that this is my third first job, meaning the third time I've been the first to do something, I want to spend time, obviously it's important to celebrate the first, but I want to spend time creating equity and inclusivity so we can celebrate the next.
I'm going to talk about that later.
Okay. Tiff, I couldn't agree with you more, and I'll spend my few seconds just drilling down and double clicking on the business case for diversity. I think, you know, no longer is DEI a nice to have for any industry, but particularly music. But it truly is a business imperative. You know, even if we talk numbers for a moment, we look at, you know, R&B and rap combined control, you know, more than 33% of the overall market share in music, as an example. If you look across business, according to Forbes, whenever a company gets diversity, equity, and inclusion right, their revenue goes up by at least 19%. And so I'm so excited about this class of chief diversity, equity, and inclusion officers here, because each of the labels, and I humbly say, and the Recording Academy got it right. You know, we understand business, and we also care about our communities. And so, you know, I don't know that there could have been a better time than right now to really get into focus the work that needs to happen to truly drive change in a measurable and tangible way. The last thing I'll say is that systems work. And Tiff, you touched on it, but you know, the equity part of what we do that so many of the viewers now don't see, I mean, every day we're crunching data. Every day we're doing data analysis across every vertical of our business to identify those opportunities and gaps, to make sure that we're bringing in new voices. We're making sure that artists are being recognized for their work. And we're making sure that not only are we hiring diverse communities, but we're procuring them as vendors. And so really thinking about the entire picture in how we're driving change is critically important. And so just thank you, Rashad, for the question, because I think systems change is where you're going to see the real action.
And I actually want to, I want to get more to system change down the line and have you all sort of break down some of, demystify some of these things that you all are looking at, so people have a better idea of what the work looks like. And if people didn't catch it, right, these folks are not only inside of organizations that some of which are competitive, some of which amplify, but they're talking to one another. They see each other as allies in this work. They are sharing strategies and thinking about sort of how to build with a recognition that success in this space is gonna require all of these organizations to be successful. And when I think when something is good one place, maybe folks are learning from it. And so I love that. And before we get to the sort of numbers piece, I wanna talk about something that, you know, a lot of people have brought up to me, right? You know, this summer, racial justice became a majoritarian issue. I'm just gonna claim it, right? Black folks and brown folks are not the majority, but racial justice became a majority, right? The people that showed up in the streets, the upticks in voter registration, all of the ways in which many people thought the best we could do in terms of activism was clap outside of our windows or uplift investigative journalism, but it was racial justice that moved people into the streets and pushed many corporations, many businesses to say things we never imagined they would say, to make statements of support and to speak out about what they were willing to do to both right past wrongs and to sort of move forward. But that was the heat of the summer. And now we are in the cold of the winter. And whenever that sort of shift happens, right, we experience sort of like maybe folks having amnesia in the wintertime, forgetting maybe the things they said in the summer. Maybe as folks dig in to making good on those commitments, they sort of maybe don't realize what they actually got themselves into. And part of your jobs is actually helping people make good on, helping move from rhetoric to action. And so I'd love it if, and maybe Dr. Mo, we'll start with you on this one. I'd love it if each of you can talk a little bit about sort of some of those challenges that you're sort of sensing, some of the sort of dynamics that is required to move us forward, move us past what always happens when we can get statements of support that actually need to be implemented to be real.
Rashad, that's a great question. And I think for me, I would say our first commitment must be to honesty. And to me, that's our biggest challenge in the DEI world. I don't know if folks are really ready, Rashad, to be honest. And this work requires honesty about ourselves, our position, our histories, and our institutions. Oftentimes, I discover we're terrified of truth telling about these things. Even for those who truly want to get it right, are you really willing? And they're not typically willing to risk getting it wrong, right? And that's the challenge. We must be willing to endure the discomfort to change. And I think if we're honest about the realities, and we know then that action must follow. And that's also what terrifies us, right? So the truth telling and then the action. If our success, think about it, is due to people who we have mistreated, it is our responsibility to reconcile that harm, right? And that might require us giving up something, whether it's money, position, or power. And I don't know if there are many people who are really ready to do that. The cost of transformation, the true cost of inclusion, the cost of equity. The question is, are we really ready to pay it or just to talk about it? And so I think that would be where I focus at in truth telling and getting us comfortable with that healthy tension.
I want to dig back in there when we get to the numbers and the metrics. I'd love it if you could expand on that. Who wants to jump in so I don't have to call on anyone?
I guess I'll jump in. Okay. Right. I want to piggyback on what Dr. Mo said, in the sense that I think what I want to provide the audience with is with an analysis that, you know, I use very often, particularly when I'm confronted with something that's traumatic or something that's less traumatic, but there's good and there's bad trauma. And reconciling the history of multiple corporations and how they've benefited from Black intelligence, Black creativity, requires all of us to take a personal audit. And that's what I ask most of the allies within Sony Music Group and anyone I talk to do. And so I think when George Floyd happened, what people did immediately was they knew what the problem was. They saw it with their own eyes. And what people didn't move to is understanding the root cause of what we just saw with our own eyes. And so what they went to, which is what you naturally go to as humans, is we wanted to express our empathy and our sadness, and to some extent sympathy, but sympathy does not breed action. Mm-hmm. And so the problem was identified, nobody really took time to understand the root cause. They kind of glazed over that part and they went immediately to saying, I have empathy. And so with that empathy, action was taken. Squares were blacked out. Commitments were made. People were hired. Teams were built. And there was a reawakening and a rediscovery of a discipline that goes back to the 60s. You know, because our timeline, particularly with DE&I, did not start last May, as you know, Rashad, and all the work that you do. And then, you know, what happened was they skipped straight to strategy without any empathy and without understanding the root cause. And the strategy was, in some cases, very performative, which is unfortunate. And all of us on this call have been in moments, and part of our careers have probably been invested in, you know, companies or systems that were performative. But now we're in the era of action and accountability. And I'm so proud of Gen Y, because Gen X was like, we're here, listen, we're ready. And Gen Y was like, oh, we've been ready, we're in the streets. And so you have multiple generations who are now kind of coming together to make the change of the promise that was given to us, you know, in the civil rights era, and now we're in 2.0. And then finally, and Dr. Mo, you touched upon this, is what sacrifice are people willing to make the real change? And that's, what is the personal sacrifice and what's the professional sacrifice? Sometimes you have to walk away from opportunities because you know exactly why you're being called. And sometimes you have to run to opportunities because you're creating and making history. And so I think, you know, I've been around moments that have become movements. You know, I've been in the thick of it. Felicia has been in the thick of moments that have become movements. And it is hard work. And I know the word time is a trigger for a lot of people. But in order to get this right, in some cases, and Rashad, you know this with your work, you hope to benefit from the changes that you're making, but you go into it with a sense of, I might not benefit from the changes that I'm making. It gets me emotional every time. I might not benefit from the changes that I'm making, but I'm going to make sure that future generations benefit from the changes that I'm making. And sometimes it takes a short amount of time to make the changes, and sometimes it takes a generation, but I hope, because of what's happened in the last year, we get to that finish line of equity faster. And I know that with, you know, my colleagues, you know, on this panel, we will do so.
I'm just so inspired. And this conversation just continues to make me feel so honored that we are on this journey together, because I just kept saying amen, amen, amen to everything that both of you are saying. And I know Felicia's about to drop some jewels too in a second. So I'll say amen in advance to what she was about to say. But like I can't like echo enough. And the national treasure is Brian Stevenson talks about a lot of of what Tiff and Mo just, and Dr. Mo just said, is that is that we have to commit to truth telling first. We can't just jump to reconciliation. We can't just jump to reparation or restoration until we're ready to tell the truth. And we're still in a bit of a denial about our history. That's why, to Tiff's point, like we want to just jump to strategy, because that will allow us to avoid the difficult conversation about how we got to here, how the rich and successful became rich and successful was off of the backs of Black people. And so one of the actions that I think that that we're working to take, or I'm working to take, is getting our executives comfortable having these types of conversations, them coaching them on how they lead conversations about race within their own individual teams, because we have to be able to normalize the conversation about race and make it less of a taboo subject for us to get to the actions. And I know you said, Rashad, you're going to get to systems a little bit later, so I don't want to steal your thunder, but like we can't talk about action without talking about the systems level changes that we have to make, and how we can kind of shake our systems and our structures. They just can't operate as they have in the past. So it is uncomfortable and virtually impossible to be a racist or a sexist or homophobic or a hater of everyone. And so I think also part of the action is embedding into our performance appraisal systems, embedding into our hiring practices, embedding into how stretch assignments are distributed, et cetera, these types of things and actions that ensure that we get to equitable outcomes. So there's this truth telling, and we have to get our executives comfortable leading conversations about truth. And then there's this systems level work that we have to do to really embed a lot of the actions that we know will get us to not just equity, justice, so that everybody, so that we've leveled the playing field for everyone, for us to really see the enduring and lasting change that we want.
I'll just piggyback, Lil, and thank you for that. And thank you also, Tiffany, for being so open and so vulnerable with us, because that's what we do, right? I think it's important for us to, you know, just always be honest, like Dr. Mo said, not only about the work that we do, but how we're experiencing the work that we do, because it's heavy. And for me, I think, you know, anyone watching has to embrace or even accept that we've entered a new normal. So just like the world won't go back to normal after the pandemic, the world won't go back to normal now after 2020. And so any company, organization, music industry professional, you know, watching, I'll say that, you know, it's just time, you know, it's actually past due time for us to really get this work right. And for me, that centers around doing the real systems work that we're talking about here. And Rashad, back to your question, I think we just have to keep this same energy mm-hmm. and keep the same momentum and hold ourselves and each other accountable. That's actually why I love the work of Color of Change, because accountability is just built into your DNA and what you do and your business model. And it's so needed, right? I think so often we want to just accept the status quo. But even as DEI officers that I hope, you know, you all, you know, get to know us and eventually trust us because we've earned that trust, we still also want to be held accountable, right? Like, we don't want to waste the seat. Yeah. Our job here is to actually drive change. And if at any point I feel like I'm no longer useful or able to drive change, or maybe my work here is done, I will get out of the way for the next person, because that's what it's about. It's not about I or any of us individually, but really about driving real generational transformation and industry transformation. And so in short, I'll say that it would be a mistake, I think, for any organization to fall into the temptation of just going back to normal, right? Or to like bury your head in the sand because maybe you're grappling with the right words to say or the right thing to do. But I would just say, be courageous right now, especially when you have us here. Like, you can call us anytime and we would love to have the conversation around how to navigate this very critical time that we're in.
Really appreciate that. You know, since the summer, a lot of folks have said, I just didn't know, Rashad. I just didn't realize structural racism, you know, and like, you know, I'm going around talking about structural racism all the time. So, you know, that can be frustrating. But my first reaction, maybe my second reaction, is, so what did you think? What did you think when you saw rooms of the folks in charge that did not look like the people doing the work? What did you think about that? When you looked at inequality or systems that were unequal and you didn't see injustice, what did you see? Did you believe it was a meritocracy, or did you believe it was something else? And I oftentimes wonder that, because there's so many stories that we tell ourselves in this country about inequality, oftentimes that make inequality unfortunate, like a car accident. Like, it sort of just happened rather than unjust, right? And so when inequality is framed as unfortunate rather than unjust, we end up with charitable solutions to structural problems, right? We end up sending water bottles to Flint instead of cleaning up the pipes, service days at inner city schools instead of changing public education. We will say Black people are less likely to get a loan from the bank instead of saying banks are less likely to give loans to Black people, right? We will say Black folks are less likely to get hired, or Brown folks or women are less likely to get hired in senior level positions in the music industry, rather than the music industry has excluded folks from those positions, right? On one hand, we get financial literacy programs or mentorship programs only. And on the other hand, we get people looking at the systems and structures that have excluded. This is not to say that mentorship programs are not something that we should do, but it's when we only try to fix the people instead of fix the systems. And so that gets me to the systems. right? And so, yes, we have to have a strategy to get there that involves truth and reconciliation, transformation, all of those things. But people who need system change will never tell you when they actually are ready for system change. And no system that's ever changed has done so without pushing and without challenging. So I want to make this really frame this, and whoever wants to jump in first, I don't know if Tiffany, you've jumped in first yet, so I might go to you. But my question really is, and maybe each of you can share something specific to the organization you're in, knowing that you've been, all been there less than a year and knowing that there's some similarities, I'd love it if each of you could sort of share a little bit about what you're tracking. What are the indicators that sort of you're looking at? What are you trying to foreground in terms of what success looks like? Because diversity and inclusion can be a thing that's really hard to track. And if I'm being very honest, there's folks in my industry, in the activist world, who are sometimes look at diversity and inclusion and be like, oh, that's the thing that they sort of put in front of us before they do the next thing. What I'm so excited about with you all as next generation leaders in the diversity field and all the ways that you're already talking about this, that you, I see you all as the inside folks to our outside folks, the folks who are gonna be our partners. And so talk to us, talk to the people who are watching. What are the things that you're uplifting? How will we know what success looks like, or anything else about the numbers and the metrics that you think people should know? Tiff, we'll start with you.
Sure. I'm actually going to send your words back to you, because anytime you've spoken in the past, I've taken feverish notes, Rashad, and something you just said, I looked it up quickly in my notes because I have notes going back to like 2012. But you said something really, really powerful, and you kind of alluded to it about presence does not equal power, and how, you know, the narratives that we tell ourselves about the story of Black people, the story of Hispanic people, the story of Asian people actually emboldens racists and systems to exclude, and policies to exclude. And you said that several years ago, and it never left me, and I had to go back to those notes. But more importantly, I think in terms of tracking, if we're successful, the things that we, and that I've set up to sort of focus on is the things that I'm hearing, you know, sort of in my listening time, because I've really only been on the job for 4 months. And, you know, I think generally when you're building a foundational exercise around diversity, equity, and inclusion, you give yourself a little bit more time, but, you know, it feels like we don't have the time. And I did speak about that a little earlier. Mobility is really, really important. I've heard that across the board, particularly within the industry, is the mobility of Black executives, because you see the output in terms of artists and R&B and hip hop, but there's a gap between what's on the inside. And I have to quote my colleague Azeem Rashad, who I had an incredible conversation with, and he reminded me, and this is really going to guide me, that there's 5 jobs in front of the mic, but there's 500 behind. And so it's how do we diversify those jobs that are behind the mic so that we can see the diversity and the support and celebration in front of the mic. And when people think about the industry, and you talked about the demystification, in talking about success, we're always artist adjacent. So I think part of our jobs too is to step not away from the artist, but show success in different ways so that we can attract the talent that we want to see within all ranks. And I think the other piece is impact, is how we treat communities outside of our companies. We've all established funds that are doing incredible work around social justice. But now what does social justice look like when it comes to DE&I? So what is that impact when you are at the intersection of diversity, equity, and inclusion and CSR? You know, and then leadership, of course, it's emboldening and nurturing our executive leadership and making sure that they're getting what they need, but also look at our emerging leaders who are coming up through the ranks. And equity, we talked about it a lot on this call, but pay equity, gender equity. I know that many of us are met with why can't you focus on everyone? I've been met with that my whole career. I couldn't stand out in some cases as a Black executive unless I stood out with everyone. But in this time, you know, and you've heard this before, this house is on fire. So what are the policies and things that we're doing to, you know, put out this house fire? I mean, I think finally just creating an environment of just safety that people feel psychologically safe, environmentally safe. Me Too shot into the future and the present, the mass indifference that women feel. And in some cases, because of the data, women of color were left out of that conversation. And so I think it's important, and Valicia has brought this up many times, data is so key in a lot of cases in establishing these initiatives, because sometimes data itself is biased and we're left out, we're not considered because we get lumped in into gender or into stereotypical roles. So really understanding the data and using it as a tool to promote all of the things that I've just talked about is to me what I'm tracking the most.
Valicia?
I can jump in and say TIFF is exactly where I am. And I'll add a layer around intersectionality. So really getting granular in the data. For example, you know, if we were to look at women overall, we may see one set of data and like things that we need to solve. But then when you do it intersectionally by race and gender, specifically women of color, you will start to see greater variance, right? So intersectionality, thinking about creators with disabilities is an example. We're thinking about LGBTQIA creators. And the list goes on to make sure that any marginalized or underrepresented community, you know, we really have a deep understanding of what are those opportunities and gaps that we need to be solving for. So just to give you a glimpse into, because every organization is different, but at the Recording Academy, we are a membership-driven organization, most known for the Grammy Awards and the Latin Grammys, but we also have Music Cares, for example, that's given over $20 million in COVID relief in the last year. We also have the Grammy Museum focused on preserving art and music. And so, you know, with all of the areas of our business, membership is really at the core. And so my analysis includes, you know, one, representation, understanding, you know, our leadership representation. We have our first African-American man, Black man serving as a dual, in a dual role of chairman of the board and CEO. Jimmy Jam was the first chairman of the board. So important to note that you have, so board representation is something I'm looking at, staff representation. So all the analysis Tiff talked about, promo and equity analysis, perf, performance equity analysis, but then also taking it a step further around supplier diversity. So what are our numbers around, you know, who we're hiring, you know, across our work and those businesses that we're investing in is a key part of the strategy. And then again, membership, really making sure that we have a thriving, diverse, super representative membership base. And for us, that means not only based on all the areas I just talked about, but also genre, right? We know, for example, as a Black community, we are not a monolith. So making sure that Black rock artists, Black jazz artists, Black gospel artists, you know, country artists are really embedded in the strategy, which is, again, why intersectional analysis is critical to make sure every voice within every community is a part of the strategy.
Liliane or Modi, you want to jump in? Anything to add?
Yeah, I can jump in. They said everything. So the only piece I think I would add outside of the representation, tracking that, the intersectionality, one thing I would lift up is that exclusion often comes cloaked as professionalism. And with that being said, right, I have to interrogate what our idea of professionalism is, because that has limited mobility and opportunity for a vast majority of folks. And so my job is now coming from everything my colleagues have said, but from the cultural standpoint, to disrupt this idea of professionalism and ensuring that everyone can show up as their authentic self and they are taken serious as professionals and given equal and equitable opportunity to occupy spaces that they have historically been denied. So I'm interrogating the culture and the environment to disrupt, again, exclusion coming cloaked as professionalism.
I love that. And I'll quickly combine everything that, that Tiff and Valicia were talking about from a representation standpoint and the safety with what Mo was talking about, with the with the exclusion piece is, and Valisha knows when we had our first conversations, was one of the things I complimented her on from a previous role is an inclusion index. So one of the things I'm eager for us to create is an inclusion index, because my North Star is getting our everyone in the organization to a belonging instinct or an inclusion instinct, where you no longer have to like spend a lot of time thinking about whether I am inviting the right voices into the room, whether I am making sure that there are people who don't look like me in places and spaces where I am, but that it becomes instinctive. And so one of the ways that we, you know, that I'm hoping to measure it is this inclusion index, which will probably be like a combination of how well are we doing from a representation standpoint, but also how well am I doing at making my colleagues feel psychologically safe? Because that with that word that Tiff talked about, that psychological safety, which I think is a key difference between inclusion and belonging, is this feeling that I can say and be whoever I am and bring up my different points of view and disagree respectfully with my colleagues without fear of retribution. And that's why that is something that is so important. It was even in my intro with you, Rashad, or the intro of me that you made, Rashad, is the creating this space where everyone feels safe so that they unapologetically and consistently unleash their superpowers. That's what we want. That's how you get successful. That's how you achieve the business outcomes that Valisha was talking about, is when everyone feels safe to unleash their superpowers. And you don't feel that way until we have figured out how to create this sense of safety and this sense of belonging where people don't feel like they are excluded. They feel like they are part of a family where they are accepted regardless of what they say.
I love that. Unleashing superpowers. That's so fantastic. You know, I hope what people are seeing right now, right? There's always a lot of talk about policy change, but you don't have policy change without implementation, without accountability, without amplification, without all of the sort of structures that actually makes the aspiration or the changes that are announced real. And what you're hearing, right, is the sort of deep conversation about how does this actually then have to operationalize itself. And that's sometimes the messy stuff, the stuff that doesn't end up in the newspaper. It doesn't end up on the stage at an award show, but it is the gap. It is the space between words and actually a changed environment. And whether we're talking about the music industry or we're talking about any industry, these conversations about sort of meeting the opportunity of a changed environment requires leaders on the inside and leaders on the outside. And that brings me to sort of my next question in terms of, you know, you all can't do this alone. Yeah, you all are brilliant, talented folks who are doing this work, who are pushing, who have made a choice to sort of lead in this space, but you need things from those on the outside, whether they are folks in the industry or outside the industry, for folks who are inside of your companies and for folks who your companies might be engaging. And as you think about sort of the road ahead and you think about the obstacles that we've talked about and the opportunities that we've talked about, what are the things that you all need? What are the sort of kind of backup that you are going to need as we sort of seek to collectively bring about change in the music industry? And anyone can jump in here.
I can say
with two quick things. One is I need everybody to feel like they're a chief diversity officer. I need every single person to feel that it is their duty, it is their obligation to reach out and find people of difference, to be open to thinking again and revisiting their thoughts and being responsible for creating a belonging instinct. So that's one. And the second thing I need is everyone to be willing to put their social capital on the line and step up and speak up in the face of injustice.
I think I'll start with the favorite thing that people like to say to me, which is, I hope one day you're unemployed. People literally say that. They say, you know what? I hope you're out of a job someday, because we're going to reach that finish line of equality and you're going to be unemployed. And so what I need people to do first and foremost is stop wishing unemployment on me. Secondly, what I would love is for people, much like Lil said, is everyone should feel like diversity and equity is their job. And I want to note that very early on in my career, I purchased this sign from an estate sale, and it said, it just simply said white women and colored women. So I knew where it came from, right? And I recognized pretty early in my career, very early, like I was an En-ROADS intern, that the boardrooms were no different than lunch counters in the sense that many of us were not allowed to enter through the front door in terms of that boardroom. Mm. We had to figure out a different path to get there. And so I want first and foremost for people to understand and know their history and how it impacts the present. Not that there's nothing new under the sun, because people love to say that, but there's patterns and they take on different forms. And so I want people to be aware, open to learning, open to reading and informing yourself and being a better caretaker of our present and our future by knowing what has happened in the past.
Anybody else want to jump in?
I can say quickly, again, everything they've said, we need everyone to show up, speak up, use your platform. We need investors to say we're not investing until we see DEI commitments and we see true outcomes. We need artists and fans to say we're not going to engage and give you our money, our artistry, our talent, our treasure until we see boards and leadership teams looking like who we look like. We need an inside and an outside approach to have that collective impact. That's how you can help us.
I'll just end it and say partnership. You know, we can't do it alone. So like Lil said, act as an owner. You know, we want everyone to be, you know, the DEI officer in their space to make sure that, you know, we're doing the right thing and your organizations are doing the right thing, but we can't do it alone. And so, you know, we're always here to have the conversations that need to be had. We're listening to make sure that we're doing the right thing. And just, you know, let's lock arms and do this together. And so I'm really excited about how our cross industry work, where it will take us this year, because I really believe that if we want to see real change happen, it's not going to be, you know, within our silos, but really by doing it together. And that's why this conversation has been so inspiring for me.
Well, so I have one quick final answer, especially since Tiffany just talked about unemployment. This idea, right, I would like to like reframe it, although I do think about what would it mean for justice and freedom to be here. And maybe I could like start my hat and pocket square line. But with that said, right, we are squarely in the space of justice, and that is a space where we are constantly passing the baton, right? And so, you know, if you left a note on the desk as you leave on to the next thing, to the person coming behind you, what do you think that person needs to know about the work, about the people, about sort of where we're heading? And, you know, we're running out of time, so maybe some quick lightning here.
Mine would simply be, I'd leave, you are enough. This job is going to make you feel inadequate, that you haven't made enough gains, that you're letting down your community and other communities, and you're pushing too hard in other ways, but you are enough. You're talented, brilliant, and committed. Stay with it. That's what I would say.
That was mine. You're here for a reason. You're qualified, you're capable, you're able, you have everything that you need. So just stay confident when it gets tough.
I mean, I would say, and it's a pretty famous quote, you know, the crown is bought and paid for, and that each of us are part of this kind of royal court of people that are just taking care of this part of the timeline. I'm very sensitive to that. I'm taking care of part of this timeline and that someone else will take care of the next part. We are part of a long line of justice warriors and peacekeepers and equity fighters. And, you know, I love the idea of you're enough, but just know that the crown is already bought and paid for.
Yes, 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 yes. I guess my note to people, to him or her would be, so much of your success or failure in this role starts up here. And what we heard articulated and what you believe to be true about you. And unfortunately, we tell ourselves so many terrible stories. And so reprogramming your brain to tell yourself that you are all of these things that they just described, and to tell yourself every morning to choose courage over comfort, because to be successful in this role, you have to be a little unafraid of losing your job, because then you won't be pushing yourself enough. So tell yourself every single day, today I will choose courage over comfort and it'll be okay.
I loved how aspirational each of those answers were, and how clear this conversation is about the work that needs to be done, that we are not there yet, and that we still have work to go. And every battle needs protagonists. And what I hope all of us do in this moment is close our eyes and think about 10, 15, 20 years from now and who we want to be in the movie of this moment. Who we want to be as this story is retold. And whatever we're doing now is part of the story that will be told about us. And in so many ways, that right is the opportunity ahead. If you are at a label, an agency, a studio, and you want to sort of learn more about the roadmap that the Recording Academy and Color of Change have put together, that we are engaging the industry around a roadmap that actually sort of moves these ideas, the rhetoric, the hope and aspiration to very clear sort of things that you can do. You can go to colorofchange.org/changemusic. The change music hashtag is a place where you can sort of engage around this work. Continue to follow these incredible leaders as they work on the inside and across the industry and support each other in this change work. Valicia, Dr. Stinnette, Tiffany, Lillian, it's been my honor, my pleasure to be in this conversation with you all. And let's go out and make as much change as possible. Thank you.